Good morning. So we continue our class this morning on the Passion narratives. Last week we talked about Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem, and the very next thing that he does is he goes into the temple, and there is your text. Jesus went into the temple of God, drove out all those who bought and sold in the temple, and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he said to them, "It is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves." Well, if he managed to offend the religious authorities by his riding into the city on a donkey like a king and accepting the praise and adulation of the crowd and refusing to rebuke his disciples at the Pharisees' request, this is just icing on the cake, okay? But let me tell you what's going on here, because there's some background that's really helpful here. So there are in the New Testament two words that get translated into English as temple. The first is simply the naos, N-A-O-S, which is sort of the same word that we use for a temple. This is what we get the English word nave actually from. It actually originally comes from ship. Naos actually is where we get nautical. It's the same root, actually, because temples were shaped like boats, or they sort of had the same, you know, long shape and all. So this is the nave, this is the naos of our temple, you know, out here. But the temple itself, the building, was comparatively small, you know, and it had the place for the priests with the altar of incense, the menorah candelabra, the table with the 12 loaves of showbread, and then there was the curtain, and behind it was the Holy of Holies. So that was inside the temple, and there was a porch on the front of the temple too. So that was properly the naos. But there was a larger area, sort of the whole temple mount, which was made up of a series of courtyards, each one higher than the next. And so when you literally went up to Jerusalem because it was on a hilltop, but you also went up literally to the temple because each step would go up, which is why those psalms those that start, about Psalm 110, 111, 112, right in there, the songs of ascent, they're called, we sing them, that's the ones that we sing at pre-sanctified liturgy. It's the 18th kathisma. In my distress I cry to the Lord that he may answer me. And it starts with that one, and all the ones we sing, those were psalms that the Jews sang as they ascended up into the temple through the various courtyards and all, till they arrived at their station inside. So we went up to the temple, and so in the around the temple there were in fact four courtyards. The first, the outermost, was the court of the Gentiles, into which anybody could come, and beyond which it was actually death for a Gentile to penetrate. Modern archaeology has found the sign that was carved in marble that hung beside the gate that pronounced death on any non-Jew who went past that. Okay? That was it. You did not defile the temple. So, there's the court of the Gentiles. Then, there's the court of women, which you enter by the beautiful gate, which is referred to in the book of Acts, to which any Israelite might come. So men and women both could go into the court of women. Next come the court of the Israelites, or the court of the men, which was entered by the gate called Nicanor's Gate, a great gate of Corinthian bronze that needed 20 men to open and shut the thing. It was so big and so heavy. Okay? And that is in this court where the men assembled for the temple services. Then there came the court of the priests, into which only the Jewish priesthood could enter, and that was where the great altar of sacrifice was and the great bronze basin for washing the sacrifices and all. And then at the back of the court of the priests is where the actual temple stood. If you think about it, court of Gentiles, court of women, court of men, court of priests, portico of the temple itself, the nave, and the Holy of Holies gives us seven ascending courtyards or places of relative holiness, you see. So was there a reason there were seven? Of course there is a reason why there's seven, because seven is a holy number. Why is seven a holy number? Because there were seven heavenly bodies, most likely. The sun, the moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, which could be seen by the naked eye. And so seven has always had, you know, spiritual significance, you know, for mankind. but increasing degrees of sanctity to which, you know, people could go at different stages. So that was it. And of course, the high priest only went into the Holy of Holies once a year on the Day of Atonement to whisper the name of the Lord and to sprinkle the blood, you know, of atonement on the, you know, on the mercy seat. So that is that. So the whole area, including all the courts, is Ieron in Greek. And so Naos is the temple proper. Ieron is sort of the whole temple precincts, okay? And so that's important. So again, the scene that this took place, where Jesus is in this story, where he drove out those who bought and sold, was in the outermost court, the court of the Gentiles. It was always crowded and busy. But at Passover, like with all of the major Jewish feasts, it was, if it was possible to go to Israel, to go to Jerusalem for the great feast, pious Jews always went. So with Passover coming up at the end of this week, Jerusalem is starting to fill up with people, and the court of the Gentiles is even busier than it usually is. Okay, it was thronged. So two kinds of trade typically went on in the court of the Gentiles. First is the business of money changing. Every Jew, according to the law of Moses, had to contribute the temple tax, which was a half shekel every year. And the problem was, in the ancient world, not all currency was really very good. The debasing of currency is an ancient and dishonorable practice that every government engaged in, which is, you're supposed to have a silver coin, and it's got a little tin or a little brass or a little copper or something else mixed in with it. And people knew. I mean, since about the 5th century BC, I forget the Greek philosopher who figured out how to tell if a statue was fully gold. Who was that?
Archimedes.
It was Archimedes, yes. Yes, where he, you know, he figured it out by immersing himself in his bathtub and displacing the water. And he figured out, you know, weight and displacement and all of that would tell you, you know, how much, you know, what the substance was made of. So the story is, of course, that he then ran through the town to the king screaming, "Eureka, Eureka, I found it, buck naked and dripping water." So he was so excited. But they knew how to test for the purity of money. So they wanted a pure half shekel. They didn't want coins that had been, as they say, rubbed, which means that some people, you know, would take the coins and, you know, file away the edges just a little bit, you know, and accumulate the silver or gold dust. And if you did this enough, you a little bit accumulates over time, okay? Did you know, just for footnotes, you know, that is why American dimes and quarters have ridges around the edges. Did you know that? Because you could tell if someone had been scraping the edges of the coin to scrape the silver off. So they figured out to put ridges on it. Of course, the coins are not all silver nowadays, but you know, before what, 1964? I think they were, in fact, you know, they were pure silver. So that's, again, you know, scraping coins is an ancient and dishonorable practice in way of sort of accumulating your own wealth. So you didn't want bad coins. Some of the coins had, you know, from different countries, had pagan images on them, you know, or images of kings, which is not appropriate in the temple. So there was a necessary trade in knowing what was, you know, you had to trade it in all your coins into something that was appropriate to put into the temple treasury. That was it. So it was a necessary function. And again, you could, it usually, the temple tax was collected before Pentecost, before Passover, but after a certain date, you could only pay it in Jerusalem. So, you know, they'd set up little stations, maybe by the synagogue or something in each village, and they'd collect it early in the year. But after a certain time, you could only pay it in Jerusalem. So when people would come for the Passover, they lined up to pay the temple tax. And so the money changers were very, very busy in those days. The problem was, of course, that money changers were always charge a little bit for their, you know, for their fees. That's why you pay $3.50 for an ATM fee, you know, if you want to go get money out of it or something like that. You know, the bank always wants its, you know, it's why free checking, you know, is such a big deal, because you can't even write a check and get access to your own money without paying the bank for the privilege of having what's your own. Okay. It got to be a little excessive. Okay. And so that's not to say that every one of the money changers was dishonest, but it certainly made for a fine area of graft and corruption. And that's what Jesus was talking about. The surplus that was charged was called kobon. It didn't all go into the money changers' pockets. Sometimes it was classed as a free will offering. Some of it went to repair the roads, okay? Some went to purchase gold plates, which was planned entirely to cover the temple. Some of it found its way into the temple treasury. It wasn't always an abuse, but it lent itself to abuse and exploitation. The selling of doves, however, was even worse. Most of the time, if you visited the temple, you know, some sacrifice was involved. Okay, and like for just yesterday's feast, for the presentation of Christ, firstborn male children had to be redeemed, and they were redeemed with two pigeons or two doves. Okay, you needed to have these in order to, when a woman came for purification after childbirth, a leper came to have a cure attested and certified. It was easy enough to buy animals for sacrifice outside the temple, but they had to be without blemish. And that sometimes was a little hard to do, you know, if you were driving your goat or your lamb from your village all the way into town, there's a chance it could be injured or something along the way. You see, in the case of doves, you could buy doves out in the city. If you bought a ritually acceptable dove in the temple, it could cost you 15 times more. Okay? And of course, if you brought your lamb, but here's a blemish here. Please, over here, a fine stock of, unblemished lamb for your sacrificial purposes. For you, oh, you're from Hebron, special price. The selling of sacrificial animals took place in a place called the Bazaars of Annas, which was the private property of the high priest Annas. So the high priest's own family was running this business of selling ritually pure animals and acceptable ones and making a killing at it. Okay? Serious abuse. Josephus mentions the abuse himself in some of his writings. Okay? So not only did he overturn the money changers' tables, and upset the dove seller stands, but this was a slap in the face of the high priest when he did it, because it was his boys who were running the business. Yeah, John.
In my language, would this be called price gouging?
Yes, you could call it price gouging. Yes. Yes, and just exploitation.
Where there's not necessarily a shortage in supply, it's simply taking advantage of people's desperation.
To a degree. I mean, the Torah is very clear about unblemished sacrifices. And that, yeah, I don't know all the details of Jewish halakha about what makes for a blemish, okay? But clearly it was an issue. I mean, we don't give God, the worst that we have. We give God the best. That's sort of the idea. So you don't want to give some sickly, gangly little runt from the litter, and say, this would be our sacrifice. I'm going to keep the good stuff for myself. So it's based on a genuine religious principle and a proper principle, but it's easy to exploit it, okay? And that's some of that was taking place, clearly was taking place at the time. And so Jesus's fiercest anger, directed against those who exploit other people, especially in the name of religion, okay? People come to the temple because the law of Moses asks them to. They want to make their sacrifices. Women want their purification. They want to make their sin offerings. They want to offer, thanksgiving to the Lord. And they go there to do it, and they run into obstacles and problems, okay? And that's what Jesus is really upset about, okay? Eric.
So Jesus was actually angry?
Oh, he was furious.
Because I heard sometimes that the Orthodox cipher was that he was dispassionate.
He is dispassionate and he is angry.
Okay.
As God, he is always dispassionate. As human, he's angry.
So
he's
like,
got to
like
be bold.
Righteous anger.
Well, yeah, but he's still mad. Yeah. Because if Jesus was incapable of anger, he wouldn't be human, because anger is a natural capacity in the human person. Mm-hmm. And if he wasn't able to be angry, he would lack that. He wouldn't be fully human. And as St. Gregory the Theologian says, what he did not assume, he did not heal. So if Jesus was incapable of anger, our anger would not have been cured by his passion, death, and resurrection.
Okay.
Yeah, no, he is really mad. And it shows us anyway, that's enough of that. So, but there's remains one thing to note. Right after this, when he's overturned all of this and, is stomping around in the temple, the blind and the lame came to him in the temple, and he healed them. Okay? So the passage sort of ends with Jesus healing blind and lame people in the temple court, right there in the court of the Gentiles. They were still there. Jesus didn't clear everybody out. He only cleared out, you know, those with guilty consciences fled before him, but everybody else was just fine. And so those who needed him are the ones who stayed. And need is never sent away empty by the Lord. All right? So that's kind of how our passage ends there. But when the chief priests and the scribes saw the wonderful things that he did, this is, again, sort of a larger vision, not just of, you know, the cleansing of the temple. And the children crying out in the temple and saying, Hosanna to the Son of David. Okay, so this is still remnants of the entrance into Jerusalem. There's still people running around the city crying, Hosanna to the Son of David. Okay? They were indignant and said to him, do you hear what these are saying? And Jesus said to them, yes, have you never read out of the mouths of babes and nursing infants you have perfected praise? Then he left them and went out of the city to Bethany and he lodged there. Okay, so he goes into Jerusalem for Palm Sunday for the day, heals, cleanses the temple, and at the end of the day, he goes back out of the city to Bethany. All right, so that's the first thing that happens next. Next comes that strange incident of cursing the fig tree. It's the next morning. So in Holy Week, this is great in Holy Monday morning. He returns to the city and he was hungry. So he's looking for breakfast. And seeing a fig tree by the road, he came out and found nothing on it but leaves and said to it, let no fruit grow on you ever again. And immediately the fig tree withered away. And when the disciples saw it, they marveled, saying, how did the fig tree wither away so soon? Okay? In Matthew's gospel, the withering of the fig tree takes place at once. You may remember in Mark's gospel, nothing happens immediately. We have in Mark has this literary device which is so common with him. It's called the Markan sandwich. Okay, so he starts a story, he goes off and does something else, and then he comes back to the original story. The prime example is Jesus going to heal the centurion servant, and then the woman with the issue of blood, you know, sort of stops the drama for a moment. She touches him. There's that whole interlude with her. Then after that, Jesus goes on back to healing the centurion servant. Okay, that's sort of the literary device. So in Mark's gospel, it's later in the day when Jesus has finished his work in Jerusalem for the day. He comes back, and lo and behold, the fig tree is withered, which is where it's given there. You see in Mark, the story is related in Mark chapter 11. It starts 11 to 14, but ends in verses 20 to 24. Okay, and there's something else that takes place in between. Yes, ma'am. I'm getting there. Yep, the whole purpose of my next discourse. You're right on track with me. All right. Give me a minute. I'm getting there. All right. First off, it's helpful if we know a little bit about the fruit-bearing habits of fig trees. The fig tree was one of the most favored trees in the Middle East in the ancient time. The picture of the Promised Land was a picture of a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees. It's in Deuteronomy 8. Pomegranates and figs were part of the treasures that the spies brought back to show off how rich the land was in the book of Numbers. The picture of peace and prosperity, which is common to every part of the Old Testament, is the picture of a time when people will sit under their own vines and fig trees, which is mentioned in 1 Kings, Micah, and Zechariah. So it was a long-standing image. And the picture of the wrath of God is the picture of a day when he would smite and destroy fig trees, which is in Psalm 105, Jeremiah, and Hosea. So the fig tree is a symbol of fertility and peace and prosperity. And it's unique in that it bears two full crops every year. Okay? So the firstborn is on the old wood from last year. Very early in the year, little green knobs appear at the end of the branches. One of my great aunts had a fig tree, and I delighted in the thing all of the time. Little knobs begin. And eventually they will become figs, but the fruit buds come in April, but they're completely inedible. It's just like they're just too bitter and harsh. They're not nearly ripe, and you can't eat them this early in the year. Bit by bit, the leaves and flowers open out. Another unique thing about the fig is that it is in full fruit and full leaf and full flower for the later crop that year, all at the same time, which is peculiar, all right? So the ripening of figs comes in June. No fig tree ever bore fruit in April, okay? But as the spring growth comes out, the new growth also produces a batch of figs, which come due in September. So you have June-bearing figs, and then you have another batch in September. And then next year, that new wood will produce another batch in June, and then the newer growth will produce again in September. So it's a very fruitful tree. It's why they loved it so much. Okay? So we see Jesus cursing a fig tree for not doing what it was not able to do, which seems unreasonable to us, you know, hence Elaine's question. Second, we see Jesus using his miraculous powers for his own end, which seems strange too, because if we remember the temptations in the wilderness, you know, the devil comes and says, well, you're hungry, turn these stones into bread so that you can eat. You know, and Jesus refused to do it back then, you know. And now, you know, he's looking for fruit when it couldn't be there, but he's going to curse the tree that wouldn't satisfy his own hunger. If we had read of anybody else cursing a fig tree because it didn't bear fruit out of season, we'd said that, you know, he's just petulant and you know, angry and immature, which is what it makes Jesus look like in this passage. In Jesus, of course, we know that's inconceivable, so there has to be some other kind of explanation. So what is it? All right. The first place it was because the whole thing is basically a symbolic action on Jesus's part. He knew full well that he wasn't going to get fruit there, but he cursed the fig tree in order to show us something and to teach us something. All right. In the first place, it teaches us that uselessness invites disaster. Idleness and uselessness invites disaster. That's the law of life. Anything that is useless is on the way to disposal. Anything can justify its existence only by fulfilling the end for which it was created. The fig tree was useless, so it was doomed. The larger context for that is the nation of Israel had been brought into existence for one reason and one reason only, that from it might come forth the anointed one, that is, that might come forth Christ. All right? He had come. His nation failed to recognize him. More, they were about to crucify him. And the nation that failed in its function, which was to welcome God's Son, was therefore a nation that was doomed. So the fig tree is symbolic of Israel, which has not brought forth the fruit of devotion and recognition of the Messiah the way it should have, all right? And secondly, it teaches us that professing faith without practicing it is condemned. The tree had leaves, and the leaves were a claim to have figs, and the tree had no figs, so its claim was false. The Jewish nation professed faith in God, but in practice they were unable to recognize God's Son, therefore they stood condemned. Further, in the teaching of the fathers, and this is a common image that comes up. I think I talked to you about this when we talked about spirituality last fall, and that is that each of us is, you know, a plant planted in the kingdom of heaven, and that we are called to bear fruit. And very often people think that coming to church and venerating the icons and reading the Bible and whatnot are bearing fruit. In fact, they're not. The fruits are love, joy, patience, forgiveness, mercy, kindness, those sorts of things. That's the fruit that's there. Religious practices and observance are only the leaves of our plants, okay? We have to put forth leaves, to be sure. And that's what nourishes our life so that we can produce fruit. But don't confuse the leaves for the fruit, all right? So, every Orthodox observance, prayer, fasting, almsgiving, receiving communion, coming to confession, venerating the icons, saying your prayers, all of that sort of stuff. That is evidence of a religious life, but those are the things, just like leaves on a tree that are out, spread out there to do what? To absorb light from the sun. So that's what we spread out in order to absorb grace from God so that we can then produce the real fruit, which is always going to be the fruit of the heart. So you know, if you're very scrupulous about your observance and you show up for every single service and you cross yourself assiduously all at the right times, but inside you're bitching and moaning about your spouse and you're cursing your neighbor and you're unhappy with the world, you ain't got any right fruit, all right? You got rotten fruit, if you have anything. Yes, Miss Elaine. There is a punishment going on, so take heed of the warning and bear some fruit. Okay, that's it. There are consequences for our actions. There really are, you know. See, in Luke's gospel, Luke's gospel takes, there's only one story about a fig tree, and it's not in this context, but it's told in the form of a parable where the master comes looking for fruit on the fruit tree, and he says he doesn't find anything and says, cut the thing down. Why is it using up the soil? And the servant says, no, here, let me cultivate around it, you know, let me fertilize it a bit. Maybe next year it'll produce something. You know, so okay, so there's your reform for your life. You know, cultivate around your heart a little bit, you know, spread a little fertilizer. Not necessarily manure. Don't spread manure, okay? Keep that to yourself, you know, but fertilize yourself and, you know, nourish the things that you need to nourish so that you can bear fruit. I mean, that's what the whole purpose of the church is. That's why the church gives us so much by way of observance, so that we can nourish our hearts, so we can come to repentance, where we come to forgiveness, we can come to mercy and long-suffering and patience and kindness and all of that. He takes it out on the tree to show us what happens if, you know, if we don't bear fruit. That's it. You're making too much of it. It's like in the Book of Job, and in a lot of stories, the contemporary meme is non-player characters. Okay, if you know what that is. All right, the fig tree is a non-player character here. It's sort of like in the story of Job. You know, Job is sitting there, you know, and you know, God tells the devil to go and afflict Job. So what does Satan go do? He goes and he, you know, the servant comes in. I was out with the flocks, and you know, they came and they took them and killed all the servants. I am the only one who escaped, you know. And then, oh, they came and they stole all the camels and they killed all the servants, and I'm the only one that escapes. You know, your sons and daughters were sitting at, you know, having a feast, and the wind came and knocked down the house and it killed them all, and I'm the only one who escaped. All right? Nobody cares about those people, okay? They're non-player characters. They're only there to set up the drama, okay? So if you get whacked out, you know, at the end, when Job gets 7 more sons and 3 more daughters, you know, and everything is sort of restored, you say, oh, but what about those poor... You're missing the point, okay? Dramatis personae, persons in the drama to set up the story. Job's the central character. Focus on Job. Don't worry about the non-player characters, okay? The fig tree is a non-player character. All right. So, Jesus answered them, assuredly I say to you, if you have faith and do not doubt, you will not only do what was done to the fig tree, but if you say to this mountain, be removed and cast into the sea, it will be done. And whatever thing you ask in prayer, believing, you will receive. And the only comment I have on that, you know, apart from the, you know, the call to faith, is that which mountain is he referring to when he says this mountain? He's there headed towards Jerusalem. He had just been in the temple yesterday. It's very likely the temple mount that he's referring to. He's still inveighing against the temple and Jewish practices there. You know, if you say to this mountain with the temple on it, be removed into the sea, it's going to go. All right? So there's still a little echo of the conflict he had yesterday in the temple. All right? On to the question of Jesus' authority. So, yes, sir, John.
First reading here is kind of problematic for me.
Okay.
This business about do not doubt.
Okay.
Because I doubt a lot. And is this a problem, or is this something that, you know, I mean, I can't even imagine how many times I come across something where I'll read that, Chinese had monotheism far before the Hebrews, and they had this expression for the way, the mm-hmm. And immediately I start thinking to myself, whoa, wait a minute, you know, what's going on here? And, you know, they're not like serious thoughts, but nonetheless, it's like my faith isn't like that rock solid that I have zero doubt all of the time. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So how does that type of thing play into this? Like where Jesus said, if you have faith, then do not doubt. I mean, is he saying, like, look, you shouldn't doubt ever? Or is he saying,
I think here again, maybe the question's a good one. The question's a big one, and you know, trying to come up with a full answer on my feet here is not really going to happen. So I think the best thing that I could say off the top of my head was, let's go ahead and distinguish again, you know, that faith has both an intellectual component and a will component. That, yeah, there are intellectual questions that we have, and we give assent to certain truths and all, about which doubts can arise, okay? And, yeah, whether the Chinese came across monotheism early, good. God's leading them in his, you know, in his own way to understand you know, his eventual revelation.
If, you know, I look at these atheist blogs, and mm-hmm. you know, I'm very engaged in the philosophical community and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll read something about the Chinese before the Hebrews had it, and then, mm-hmm. well, you know, Aristotle reasons to a singular creator too.
Yep.
You know, but nonetheless, it does, like, I don't know, it's even qualified as a doubt, or is that, like you said, an intellectual kind of...
I think it's just a question. I think it's just a question, and it's interesting. It's fun to play with. You know, does it undermine your faith? Probably not. And again, faith also has that volitional aspect to it too, which is fidelity that we stick with. You know, sometimes even in the face of intellectual questions and all. You know, where else will we go? You know, to quote Peter, you've got the words of eternal life. I don't know what you're doing. I don't understand what's going on. You know, my life is a wreck, but I'm going to stick with Jesus regardless, because he's the only one who's got any kind of answers. And I may not understand it now or ever, but I know this is the right place for me to be, and I'm going to be here. And maybe that's more that fidelity in that sense. That might be more.
What qualifies as a doubt? I guess that maybe that's my confusion. Is that
I can't give you a quick answer to that.
I'm not
okay, saying. Yeah. Yeah, because also what's rolling around in the back of my mind, you know, by way of sort of faith and doubts and all these sort of things, there's this remarkable story in the Lives of the Desert Fathers that they recounted that some woman, rather like the widow of Nain in the Gospel, this old widow woman is, you know, mourning the loss of her only son, which in those days meant she had no income, she was reduced to poverty. And being an elderly woman, she was probably too old to be a prostitute. I mean, she was reduced to begging. And here was this pathetic scene, this poor woman whose life is functionally over, going to bury her son. And it says, and there passed by, forgive the vulgarity of the story, there passed by a prostitute still stinking from her last sin, who saw the procession and cried out, "Oh God, could nothing be done to save this woman's son?" And he sat up and was restored to life on the prayer of a prostitute just coming back from her last engagement, which is an astonishing thing. What does that say about faith? Now, I'm not real sure, but there's something really powerful there that ought to give us all pause. And that sounds very much like what Christ is talking about in this gospel passage. It's not the faith that'll remove a mountain to the sea, but if it's a cry of faith like that, maybe out of compassion for the poor woman, I don't, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, if you know, if you can cry out to God with sincerity and, you know, passion like that, maybe that's what it's about. I don't know. It's a very good question. This is fun to talk about and to think about, isn't it? Yeah. All right, let's see if we've got a minute longer to talk about the question of Jesus' authority. So, he came into the temple. Again, this is, if we're in Holy Week, this is Monday morning. The chief priests and the elders of the people confront him as he was teaching and said, "By what authority are you doing these things? Who gave you this authority? Because it sure as hell wasn't us." But Jesus answered and said to them, "I also will ask you one thing, which if you tell me, I likewise will tell you by what authority I do these things. The baptism of John, where was it from? From heaven or from men?" They reason among themselves, saying, "Hey, if we say it's from heaven, then he's going to say, why didn't you believe him? But if we say from men, well, we're afraid of the multitude, for everybody counts John as a prophet." So they answer Jesus and says, "We don't know." Which was a lie. They perfectly well had an answer. They were just afraid of it. And he said to them, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things." Deliberately assumed ignorance of cowardice. All right? They knew what the truth was, but they were just scared to say it. So they lamely said, "I don't know the answer." And they knew perfectly well the answer, but they're afraid to give it. So the true question is not what is it safe to say, but what is it right to say? And in this case, you know, the Pharisees and the religious authorities failed that. All right. So Jesus shuts them up in that case. All righty. Anything else for the good of the cause? Ain't this fun? This is fun. See, we never get into this stuff. That's why I said these, you know, going through these passages that we never hear Sunday Gospels about or anything is really opens up some really sweet stuff. So that's it for today. We'll go on next week. Thank you too much.